Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the US role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the US involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The US military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became US soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the US troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and US special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while US officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the US announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the US to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts towards promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
The confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kyiv. The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitment to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kyiv. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine and was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kyiv is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kyiv.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
By announcing his decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tanks supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly. The U.S. Defense Department announced in early January 2023 that it would give an additional $3.1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. In total, the U.S. approved about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine in 2022. About half of that money, or $24.9 billion, went towards military spending. The U.S. also gave $9.6 billion to Ukraine for what it has described as non-military purposes in 2022. It is believed that the small number of Western-supplied tanks manned by poorly trained crews and lacking maintenance and supply infrastructure support is likely to yield negative results. Furthermore, the first deployment of U.S. main battle tanks in Ukraine must come by a significant Ukrainian army success. That would require no fewer than 200 to 300 tanks. The question is whether Western countries are prepared to go for a full-blown confrontation with Russia.
in the limelight.
In California, United States, a family wants to know why police shot their son, a 36-year-old double amputee who used a wheelchair. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered this story and tells us more. As they do every week during football season, the Lowe family gathered on Sunday morning, 29th of January, to watch the NFL games on two big flat screens in the South Los Angeles home of the family matriarch. But as the San Francisco 49ers prepared to face off against the Philadelphia Eagles, there was one fewer family member watching. Anthony Lowe, a 36-year-old, had been shot and killed by Huntington Park police officers in California on Thursday afternoon, 26th of January. Instead of talking football, the family spoke in hushed tones to the grainy cell phone video they'd seen the night before. Anthony Lowe, a double amputee, trying to run from Huntington Park police officers on what was left of his legs, while holding a long-bladed knife. Anthony Lowe's lower legs had been amputated last year. In the video, he appears to have just dismounted from a nearby wheelchair. As he scrambled down the sidewalk away from the uniformed police officers, two police sport utility vehicles drove into the frame and parked, blocking the camera's view. The video, which was posted on Twitter on Saturday, 28th of January, then abruptly ends. No footage of the ensuing gunfire has been released. Yatoya Toy, Anthony Lowe's older sister, identified the man running from police as her brother. She said his legs had been amputated after an altercation with law enforcement in Texas, although the family has no more information about that incident. This is the first Sunday where he ain't watching the game with us. It's what he loves to do, Toy said. She still uses present tense when referring to her brother, who has two teenage children. He's the life of the family. He brings happiness, joy. He loves to dance. He's very respectable. He loves his mother. He's the favorite uncle. The kids all love him. Lowe's death is a devastating loss for the close-knit Lowe family, Toy said, and it comes at a time of increased scrutiny of police brutality and violence after a string of high-profile incidents, including the beating to death of 29-year-old Ty Nichols by Memphis police this month. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Homicide Unit is investigating Anthony Lowe's shooting, as it typically does for all shootings involving Huntington Park Police Department officers, according to the unit's Lieutenant Hugo Reynaga. A detective with the homicide unit stopped by the home of Dorothy Lowe, the dead man's 53-year-old mother, on Saturday to interview the family. They responded, Toy said, by peppering the detective with questions about Anthony Lowe's death. The answers the detective provided were vague and unpersuasive, Jackson said. Their biggest question, what was so threatening about a disabled double amputee with a knife that it necessitated shooting him? Something is not right with this situation, said Tatiana Jackson, another sister of Anthony Lowe. My daughter is 4 years old and she adores him. It's going to break my heart to let her know. She does not understand. She was looking for him like, is he hiding from me? I can't bring myself to tell her that he will never come back again. Lieutenant Hugo Reynaga said in a phone interview on Sunday that the Sheriff's Department has collected video of Anthony Lowe's shooting from a nearby business, but that it does not intend to release the video footage. Huntington Park police officers, he said, do not wear body cameras. Hugo Reynaga said two officers fired at Anthony Lowe somewhere around 10 times. We recovered 10 or 11 casings at the scene. I don't know which of those actually hit him. Hugo Reynaga said the names of the two officers who shot at Anthony Lowe will be released in the coming days. The police officers, he said, are on leave for a few days while they undergo a psychiatric evaluation, and they will be assigned administrative duties until the command staff approves them to go back to field work. Asked if there is any discussion of charges against the police officers who opened fire on Anthony Lowe, Hugo Reynaga said, no. The Huntington Park Police Department did not return calls requesting comment on Sunday. Asked why it was necessary to shoot Anthony Lowe, Hugo Reynaga noted that the officers repeatedly tased him, to no effect, before opening fire. The Sheriff's Department's initial statement about the shooting investigation, released on Friday, 27th of January, said Anthony Lowe twice tried to throw his knife at police officers. But Hugo Reynaga said on Sunday that Anthony Lowe did not throw the knife ultimately, but he made the motion multiple times over his head like he was going to throw the knife. Hugo Reynaga said he did not know how many times Anthony Lowe was actually tased. Fox 11 Los Angeles, part of the Fox News Channel, has also covered this story and tells us more. A 36-year-old stabbing suspect, who police shot and killed in Huntington Park, California, was identified on Saturday, 28th of January 2023. Anthony Lowe was identified as the victim by the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. Police officers from the Huntington Park Police Department responded to a stabbing call at 3:40 p.m. on Thursday, 26th of January, in the 2400 block of Slauson Avenue. Upon their arrival, the victim gave them a description of a suspect in a wheelchair, according to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department's Information Bureau. After searching the area, police officers located the suspect near the 1900 block of Slauson Avenue, and as they tried to detain him, Anthony Lowe allegedly drew a 12-inch butcher's knife and attempted to throw the weapon at the police officers. According to detectives, Lowe was tased at least twice by the police officers, but he attempted to throw the butcher's knife at them again. Officers then fired at Anthony Lowe, who was struck by gunfire in the upper body. Anthony Lowe was treated at the scene by Los Angeles County Fire Department paramedics, but was pronounced dead at the scene. Police said they recovered a butcher's knife at the scene of the incident.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and scholars. I am Atan, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding Shiite fuqaha, Imami Faqis of the late 6th century Hijra. He is no one but Muhammad ibn Mansur ibn Ahmad ibn Idris Hilli, mainly known as Ibn Idris, the author of As-Sara'ir. So, Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. This episode, give us some information about the early life and background of Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Muhammad ibn Mansur ibn Ahmad ibn Idris al-Hilli, which is known as Ibn Idris, yes, was one of the Imami jurists living in the 6th Islamic century. And actually, he was... He died in Hilla, one of the cities of Iraq, and buried there, I think. So he was one of the offsprings or the grandchildren of Shaykh Tusi, rahmatullahi alayh. And among the teachers of this outstanding scholar, we can mention Abdullah ibn Ja'far, ibn Zuhri, Halabi, ibn Shahri, Oshub. These are the great scholars who were among the teachers of Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
Yes.
Then among the students of him also there are very well-known scholars like Fakhar ibn Ma'di Musawi, Ja'far ibn Nammab al-Hassan, Ali ibn Ahya Khayyat, and the other scholars.
Okay.
So he wrote lots of books. One of them is Sara'ir, and the other one is Khulasatul Istidlal fi al-Mawasa'ati wal-Mudayaqa, al-Mukhtasar fi al-Mudayaqa, Risala fi Ma'na al-Nasib. So these are, of course, the works written by Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
That's right.
And one of the important points that could be mentioned regarding Ibn Idris al-Hilli is that Shaykh Tusi, rahmatullah alayh, was a very great and outstanding scholar in history, in a way that after the demise of Shaykh Tusi, the other students and followers of Shaykh Tusi could not criticize his ideas, his viewpoints.
Or his method of research in fiqh was specific to him, okay?
They said for 120 years, no one could criticize or oppose the ideas or the methods of Shaykh Tusi. And it was the Ibn Idris al-Hilli, the first important scholar of Shia, who criticized some of the viewpoints, some of the ideas of Shaykh Tusi.
That's right.
Actually, he encouraged the rest of the scholars to be critical in regards with the ideas and the theories developed by the other scholars.
Okay.
So actually, we can say that he developed and improved the Shiite, let's say, sciences or knowledges and the history.
Okay.
That's why his role is very much important into the development of different sciences and the history of Tashayyu.
And what was Ibn Idris's main approach that made him different from the followers of Shaykh Tusi regarding fiqh, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, after Shaykh Tusi, we could say he was a great scholar, like Shaykh Tusi was a great scholar. And no one had the courage to basically argue against what he has, you know, brought in his book or the fiqh or jurisprudential, you know, the rulings that he has brought. So Ibn Idris was the first person who, after 120 years, did so. The main approach was the because he was following the intellect and he brought intellectuality in the fiqh or jurisprudence.
Okay.
You know, the reason is, you know, when we talk about the jurisprudence or the fiqh, some of the ulama, they just follow the narrations. And whatever is in the narrations, they use that. On the other hand, we have another group of ulama who use the narrations. And on top of that, they analyze the things, you know, according to the time.
According to the time.
They're the changes. For example, if it is...
So, you want to say that it was changed from a static approach to a dynamic one.
Dynamic approach.
Okay,
yes.
That's right.
So, Ibn Idris was the first scholar who came up with this idea. And obviously, that's why he had some arguments... or differences in the fiqh, which was different from the ideas which was provided by Sheikh Tusi.
Sheikh Tusi,
and
right.
Due to this, some has, you know, basically tried to devalue his works. But on the other hand, we know that the
ulama... Or it's better to say chose a different approach.
Yes, it was a different approach.
Tusi, that's right, okay.
And this opened a door for the Shia school of thought to go towards the ijtihad. You know, the ijtihad was... going down, but he raised up, he boosted the level of ijtihad after 120 years of passing of, you know, Sheikh Tusi. So this was the main approach that he had in his books, which has opened. And after that, we can see day by day the advancements that we have in the Shia ijtihad. We can say the main person who has started this after Sheikh Tusi is Ibn Idris.
Oh, that's all right. So, as you said, the great point that you made. So, in order to adjust the fiqhi rulings with the we can say necessities of the time, the time and era, this was what Ibn Idris was after. And As-Sarair was such a book, isn't it?
Yes.
Shaykh Rouhani, explain a little bit more, because this is believed to be the magnum opus of Kitab al-Sarair by Ibn Idris.
Yes, you know that fiqh or jurisprudence is one of the very, we can say the most significant field of studies in Islam is jurisprudence.
Yes.
And when it comes to jurisprudence, of course, different scholars, they try to get the most authentic fatwa. When they issue, for example, a fatwa or they explain a hukm of Islam, they should make sure themselves that this hukm or this ruling or assertion that they assert regarding a certain thing, it should be trustable, it should be true, it should be valid, you know. So that is why in different centuries, so different scholars might experience or might test different kind of methods.
Yes.
So the methodologies of the studies by different scholars might be different.
Okay.
But the point is that, for example, when it comes to the people like Sheikh Ibn Idris Hilli, who lived, for example, in the 6th century, of course, he should not be only a follower of the other scholars. Because in Shiite teachings, among the Shiite scholars, we have ijtihad. Ijtihad means that you should try your best, you yourself, to find out the most authentic ahkam of Islam based on your own method, based on your new kind of methods, which should be compatible with the needs of your time.
Yes.
So that's why this way we can say that Ibn Idris Hilli played a very great role into the advancement and development of the Shiite jurisprudence.
That's right.
Though, for example, he followed in many areas the Sheikh Tusi and other scholars, but in some specific areas he had his own ideas, his own viewpoints, his own, let's say, judgment about the methods and the ideas and the fatwa of the other scholars. So it paves the ground for the rest of the scholars in the coming centuries to do the same thing and to improve and to develop actually the ijtihad in the fiqh of Islam or in the Islamic jurisprudence.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha
illallah. Just entering the topics, the miscellaneous topic into a fiqhi book, like for example, usul, fiqh al-lugha, rijal, you know, diraya, fiqh al-mugharan, or we can say akhlaqi points, beside the other, make As-Sarai a very dynamic book and beautiful to read, isn't it?
Yeah, so obviously when he's using the intellect and he wants to analyze the things according to the time,
yes,
he has no other choice than, you know, bringing these things. And this was one of the significant things that he did. For example, when he was talking about a jurisprudential law or a fiqhi rule, he was first argumenting on the principles of jurisprudence, okay, which is related to that, the usul,
yes,
that were made. And after that, in many things, for example, when we have the, you know, terminologies, he used to go towards the lughat, uh-huh, of the Arabic.
Very good.
And try to find the main meaning of that word.
Okay.
And then try to talk about that. You know, similarly, we had this, for example, you know, we have many scholars who, when they bring the, you know, the Islamic ruling, they first discuss the meaning of the word from different aspects. And then which meaning is being, you know, taken. This is very important because, you know, one word and its meanings can change many things. For example, okay, you know, in the Quran, the first verse is Bismillah.
Okay.
And there's a letter ba in the beginning. It has 22 meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Which one to take? Do I need to take the meaning of with, in relation to? Mm-hmm. You know, letter ba has different,
yes,
meanings. So
yes,
these things have, obviously, this has effects. And this is the main major, we can say, effect when we see a difference of opinion in many, you know, jurisprudential rules and laws, for example. And on top of that, you know, rijal was important. Obviously, the narrators who are narrating this, you know, particular narration from which we want to, tell people a rule, an Islamic rule, because, you know, Islamic rule means that you either say people that this is an obligation, you need to perform this,
okay,
it's wajib. And if you do not perform such a thing, then obviously it is haram. So the,
okay,
the fiqh is basically,
yes,
around the halal, haram,
yes,
mubah,
yes,
something which is, you know, allowed, mustahab, and makruh. So basically, this is important that the narration that you're taking, it should be from an authentic source. It cannot be without that.
Yes.
And on top of that, obviously, the major difference of Ibn Idris from the others was in the chapter of Diraya, where, you know, he never believed on Khabar Wahid. You know, we had this discussion,
yes,
before,
yes,
in one of the
before,
programs,
yes,
that a single, we can say, you know, source is not accepted.
Yes.
The, if it is from one person. So there are many other things, obviously. And on top of that, you know, the fiqh al-maqarin.
Yes.
Fiqh al-maqarin means the fiqh or the jurisprudence or laws of this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was something at the time of the Prophet.
Yes.
But now, for example, you know, when the thief,
yes,
was, you know, arrested at that time, there was another time of another type
the
of
punishment was different.
But now, can we
do
the
that?
Same or not?
Okay.
Or we need to change.
Yes.
Or there are many other things,
that's,
you know,
all right,
that we have. So these discussions were basically brought by Ibn Idris into the fiqh.
You know, in a chapter in his book called Tamfizul Ahkam, on that time he talks about, for example, the main leader of a society, a person who is going to, at the time of ghiba, of an infallible imam, you know, be in charge of a Muslim land and a Muslim society. What are the priorities? What are the conditions for such a man? And he tackled this issue. Maybe some people think that, for example, the concept of wilayat faqih is something new, but, you know, Ibn Idris has tackled it. Also, we can say jihad. What is jihad? All in all, as you said, istidlal, argumentation, istinad, documentation, you know,
the fiqh al-maqarin, which is,
yes,
you know, between the different school of thoughts.
That's all right. Okay. So, Sheikh Rouhani, anything missed about Al-Sarair and this,
yes,
you know,
as
fatwas?
You rightly mentioned, one of the very important concepts that is dealt with by Ibn Idris Hilli is wilayat al-faqih,
mm-hmm,
because he is of the view that we cannot suspend or conceal or cancel, for example, the rulings of Islam at the time of Ghaiba.
Yes.
So, of course, first it is the Imam al-Ma'soom who be, for example, the ruler. But, of course, if there is no access to Imam al-Ma'soom directly in the Asr al-Ghaiba, in the major occultation, so, of course, at this time, fuqaha, the jurists, should take this responsibility and, of course, should rule over the people, and the people should actually follow and obey whatever is ruled by or issued, whatever fatwa, for example, or hukm is issued by the Shia jurist. So that's why he was of the view that in each and every kind of areas like economic, social, political, or religious kind of affairs, we have to refer to jurists, and whatever jurist actually issued the hukm or assert a hukm, we have to follow.
That's all right. Thank you very much for a nice elaboration. He passed away in the year 597 or 98, according to the Sulh Hijri calendar, in Hilla, in a neighborhood called Jama'ain in Hilla. And we know that Hilla, beside Najaf, you know, Qoms, Mashhad, you know, Karbala, is again one of the most outstanding cities that has produced outstanding scholars, Shiite scholars during the history of Islam, and so many great scholars like Ibn Idris Ali are from that region. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man and the author of As-Sara'ir, Ibn Idris Al-Hilli. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight. The Zionist regime's medical blockade of Gaza has been described as one that gravely breaches residents' rights to healthcare in Gaza and outside. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Monitor wrote in this regard, Gaza's health ministry accused the Zionist regime of delaying the entry of several X-ray machines needed to treat patients in the blockaded Palestinian territories, Reuters reports. The ministry said requests in the past 14 months for 8 different types of X-ray machines and spare parts to repair existing equipment had been rejected or delayed. Dozens of other X-ray machines were allowed into the impoverished coastal enclave during the same period. The fabricated regime of Israel, which together with Egypt maintains a blockade around Gaza, citing security concerns, says it is worried about groups commandeering such machines for other purposes. Health Ministry Director Medhat Abbas said the equipment was funded by international relief and medical institutions on behalf of hospitals in Gaza. Abbas told Reuters, holding back the entry of that equipment caused a delay in providing medical services to thousands of patients. Requests for such equipment, COGAT told Reuters, are examined on a case-by-case basis. Abbas said the Zionist regime's assertions about the medical equipment having dual uses were a lie. At Gaza City Shifa Hospital, Nalat Zaino, 51, said she had been waiting 45 days to have an X-ray done of her kidneys. Doctors blamed the delay on the withholding of equipment. As if the pain I am feeling wasn't enough, waiting has been another form of torture, the mother of four told Reuters outside the X-ray unit. The ensuing blockade, limiting the amount of goods crossing in and out, has crippled Gaza's economy and healthcare system, which suffers from a chronic shortage of hospital beds and medical equipment. Meanwhile, Arab News reported the Zionist regime's ban is not limited to medical equipment needed for hospitals in Gaza. It is also preventing the entry of spare parts for broken equipment in Gaza and the transfer of equipment for repair outside. Gaza's health ministry accused the Zionist regime of exposing patients in intensive care and those with cancers, heart diseases, strokes, and complex fractures to health risks, as they are being deprived of devices that identify health problems and the required medical interventions. The Ministry of Health called on the relevant bodies to put direct pressure on the Zionist regime to bring in medical and diagnostic equipment and spare parts for broken equipment to save patients in the Gaza Strip from the guillotine of the occupation and the blockade by providing for their full treatment needs. Patients are forced to transfer to other hospitals outside the Gaza Strip, including hospitals in Al-Quds or the West Bank, and some in Egypt and Jordan, in order to obtain a diagnosis before starting treatment due to the lack of medical equipment. Samir Abu Al-Ain, 55, said he had to wait for 2 months until he obtained a medical referral and an Israeli permit to travel to Al-Quds for examinations at Augusta Victoria Hospital. Abu Al-Ain told Arab News, "I was diagnosed with cancer several months ago. Before that, there were suspicions on the part of the attending physician, but he was unable to identify the disease until after I got a diagnosis in Al-Quds, and I had to wait a long time until I got the necessary papers." He added, "It is not enough that we suffer from diseases, we suffer from waiting also, and the fear that treatment will not be available. Many of the medicines that the doctor prescribed for me are often not available, and I have to wait a long time until they are. Obtaining a medical referral to hospitals outside the Gaza Strip involves a long series of bureaucratic procedures." The Palestinian Center for Human Rights warned of the serious repercussions resulting from the Zionist regime's continued block on import equipment, which is needed to save the lives of thousands of patients in the Gaza Strip hospitals. Patients also suffer while waiting for a pass from the Zionist regime to Al-Quds and the West Bank, with dozens of them facing the Zionist regime's security bans. The primary responsibility for providing medical supplies to the population of the Gaza Strip lies with the Zionist regime's occupation, according to Articles 55 and 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, said the center. More than 2.3 million people in Gaza depend on governmental health facilities to receive treatment, while these facilities suffer from serious deterioration as a result of the blockade policy imposed by the Zionist regime occupation authorities on the strip for more than 15 years, it said. The center added that the internal Palestinian division resulted in the fragility of the health system and a permanent shortage in the list of essential medicines and medical devices, in addition to the shortage of specialized medical staff.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. If you are caught in a situation where you have to choose between saving a child's life and working in an office, the child's life comes first. Do you have any doubts about this? No. No woman has any doubt that a child's life comes first if she's in a situation where she has to choose between a child's life and working in an office. The same goes for a child's behavior, a child's faith, and a child's upbringing. In other words, in the same way that you have no doubt about saving a child's life, the same also applies to a child's upbringing. Of course, there are some places where you can come up with a solution in one way or another for the so-called doubts between this and that, and solve these in cases. But if there are truly times when you have no other option than this, that is the child, takes priority over that, that is working in the office. However, if that work is permissible and necessary, and in some cases it is imperative, if that social work is obligatory at times, it is a duty. You must do that work. In that case, you must do it.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the extent to which it is obligatory depends on how important that obligatory action is. Now, I use the person's life as an example, but there are times when the importance of an obligatory action is higher than the life of a child, the life of a spouse, or the life of someone's parent. Thus, when you address Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Ziyarah Ashura, you say, "May my father and mother be sacrificed for you." Who else is higher than a person's father and mother? May their lives be sacrificed for you. Or there is a verse in the Holy Quran that states, "Say, if your fathers and your sons, your brethren and your spouses, your kinsfolk, the possessions that you have acquired, and the trade in which you fear a loss, and the dwellings you are fond of are dearer to you than Allah and His Messenger and fighting in His way, then wait until Allah issues His edicts." The Holy Quran, chapter 9, ayah 24. We should not love these things more than God and jihad in the way of God. That is how it is in some places.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar was gripped by fear and chaos after a bomb ripped through a mosque situated close to the police headquarters. The injured were taken to the nearby hospitals by rescue workers. Crowds were seen hurrying to the blast site and hospitals in search of their loved ones.
We were assembled in the mosque for the evening prayers. I was among those who were ready to offer prayers. All of a sudden, a massive explosion occurred and the roof of the mosque collapsed suddenly.
After this attack, the government of Pakistan has vowed to fight back against terrorists until the last drop of their blood.
We will not spare those who want to sabotage the peace of the country. We will chase after them. All political stakeholders should sit together to maintain peace in the country.
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed responsibility for the attack. However, later they distanced themselves from the bombing, saying it was not their policy to target mosques, seminaries, and religious places. Experts say the Pakistani government needs to take up the issue of growing terrorism with neighboring Afghanistan. The Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan militants are said to be hiding in Afghanistan while carrying out attacks inside Pakistan once in a while.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately. The Taliban tried to broker a peace deal with between the government of Pakistan and TTP. Parleys were held, talks were held behind the scene between the security forces of Pakistan and the TTP leadership, but that didn't work.
The country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has appealed to the people for blood donations for the injured in a terrorist attack in Peshawar on Monday.
Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Analysts believe that government has to deal decisively with Taliban militants to maintain peace and economic stability of the country. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation's religion or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims based on their religious beliefs never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kiev and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP-T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP-T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
d'Italia a livello internazionale.
Italy counts very little at an international level.